Here's a pioneer. Each Sunday at this time, the Pioneer Sheet Metal Company of Anchorage presents these interviews with pioneers of Alaska, those men and women who came north in the early days and who by their lives and actions have made Alaska one of the best places in the world to call home. We've interviewed quite a few pioneers on this program that came up in the days of 98, around the turn of the century, but this, I believe, is the first time we've had the pleasure of interviewing a man who was born in Alaska and who's made Alaska his home. I'd like to have our radio audience know Simeon Oliver. Simeon, you were born in Alaska, weren't you?
Yes, Jack. I was born in the village of Chignik, down on the peninsula of Alaska.
That's down on the Alaskan Peninsula.
Reaching out toward the Aleutians, yes.
I understand, though, Simeon, that you're part Eskimo extraction. Is that right?
Yes. Mother was an Eskimo, father a Norwegian.
Mm-hmm. How does it happen that you were down on the peninsula? Did your parents reside there?
Father was trapping there at the time. He found my mother as a girl on a sled. Her father had been frozen to death, and it so happened he found this sled on his trap line in the interior of the peninsula. He resuscitated the girl, brought her to life, and took her to the village, mm-hmm. educated her in the States, and brought her back and married her. I was her first child.
Mm-hmm. Well, you lived down in the Aleutians then most of the time, is that right?
After Mother died, when I was 2 years old, Father sent me to a Methodist mission in the village of Unalaska in the Aleutian Islands, and it was in that mission that I was reared.
Mm-hmm. That is the Methodist mission down
the Jesse there. Lee home.
Mm-hmm. That's the same one that was later moved to Seward.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you spend a very long time in the Aleutians? Did you live your early life there in the home?
I grew up in that mission until I was 19. And in the years there, worked out during the summer months when I became of age, that is in my early teens, in the industries of that part of Alaska. These industries were fishing of all types, commercial, cod, halibut, salmon, herring, and so forth, whaling out of the harbor of Akatan. I spent 2 summers in the Pribilof Islands working in the fur seal industry as a boy, and 2 summers in the Bristol Bay area in the salmon fishing industry.
Mm-hmm.
There followed, in my last year as a boy in the Aleutians, a summer in the crater of a volcano working for a sulfur mining corporation on the island of Akun.
Did you say in the crater of a volcano?
Actually in the crater, yes.
For heaven's sake. And they were mining copper in the crater?
Sulfur.
Sulfur, excuse me.
Sulfur.
How large was that crater, Simeon?
It was perhaps half a mile across. One portion of it was blown out, so the crater, the interior of the crater, faced the Bering Sea.
Oh, one wall was blown away.
Completely blown away, yes.
The crater. Well, that's interesting. Are they still mining down there?
No, this mining industry has gone out of business.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned, too, the whaling and the cod fishing. Those businesses are no longer active in the Aleutians, are they?
The whaling industry closed in 1939 because of the shortage of whales. This station in the islands was the last of 3 to operate in Alaska waters.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, the Aleutians seem to have been, in those days, quite an active place for industry. Are they pretty much died out now as far as industrial workings go?
Yes, in the cod and halibut industry, when I was a boy, there were fleets of vessels that would go into the Bering Sea to fish out of Dutch Harbor. Mm-hmm. But because fishing fields found closer to the market exist, this Bering Sea fishing industry no longer exists.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that you are probably more interested in the arts now than in industry, but could you give me a brief answer to this? Is there enough natural resource in the Aleutians to build that up someday? Do you think that the country will grow industrially?
I think so. In the fishing line, the sea holds great resources in clams, mussels, crab, even shrimp, herring, cod, and halibut. The salmon have never done very well out there.
How about in the minerals? Do you have natural resources there?
Not a great deal. Not a great deal. The islands are too new, geologically speaking.
Well, Simeon, I know that you are a concert pianist. Didn't you ever worry when you were working down there about injuring your hands? Or hadn't you become interested in music at that time?
I was interested in music, but I had no aims toward the concert stage at the time. I just played for the love of it.
And your musical career developed after that then?
Yes, mm-hmm. In the States.
You were playing for radio and concert work both in the States, were you not?
After I eventually got to the States and studied at the Chicago Musical College, I went into radio in Chicago first, and from that point branched out into the concert field.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me just a few of the people that you've studied with, Simeon?
My scholarship at the Chicago Musical College was under the eminent teacher pianist Maciej Bogusławski, who headed the piano department in that school. There were 2 years under him and a summer under Percy Granger, the Australian pianist, who is now an American citizen, and Rudolf Ganz, mm-hmm. who is now president of that college. He was the great Swiss pianist and perhaps one of the greatest exponents of Franz Liszt music in his day.
May I ask you this? How did you happen to give up a musical career, your musical career, to come back to Alaska?
Well, that's a long story, Jack. It was largely because of the death of my first wife. I gave that up, then decided to go into the research in music along the Arctic coast and in the Aleutians. Mm-hmm. And since 1936, I've been devoting considerable time to that.
Well, I imagine native music is quite tied up or woven into their cultural life, isn't it? Doesn't that lead you farther astray than just music, your research?
Into the folklore. The folklore and music tie in together. Mm-hmm. Many of the folk tales will have songs as a part of the tale, mm-hmm. to illustrate it.
Well, when did you start that research?
I began this work in 1936. An idea that I had always had in my mind of someday coming to Alaska to study this, not only for my own interest and pleasure, but to put down in black and white the music which is rapidly vanishing.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you maintain this work? Do you lecture to maintain the work itself?
Yes.
You do?
Yes. My lecture tours in the past have financed my tours to Alaska, mm-hmm. to the Arctic, and into the Aleutians.
Well, that was a rather bad time to be doing any work. Didn't the war kind of stop your research work?
Yes. When the Japanese bombed Dutch Harbor, which is my home on Alaska and Dutch Harbor, one in the same place, I enlisted into the Army. I was in New York at the time and enlisted into the Army to serve in Alaska and was stationed here by the War Department, the G2 headquarters at Fort Richardson.
Mm-hmm. They sent you all the way from New York to take advantage of your knowledge of the country?
Yes.
Could you tell us what kind of work you were doing during the war?
Well, part of it was to lecture soldiers going into the Aleutians prior to the campaign of Attu and Kiska on foraging and the emergency foods existing in the Aleutians to show them how to identify the edible vegetable growths, the berries, the various types of beach foods, and the sea foods to determine the edible from the inedible. There are poisonous plants down there. There are many types of fish which are not edible.
I suppose you were probably the one then that talked to the rangers who went ashore on the islands down there?
No, most of those boys were very carefully selected by Colonel Kastner, who headed the, or who organized the Alaska Scouts, and they were familiar with all of these things. It was the soldier coming in from the States who was not familiar with the country.
I see.
To whom I gave talks on these foods.
Well, Simeon, did the war upset the balance, the economic balance of life in the Aleutians?
Completely disrupted. Yes, the natives were evacuated from all of the islands of the chain, including also the Pribilof Islands. The Japanese captured 42 prisoners from the island of Attu, took them to Japan as prisoners of war. While there, half of their numbers died, 21 of them died. 4 of the 5 babies born in Japan to this group died there. Just one exists. He's living in Attu now with the group there who have been finally returned to the islands.
The government returned the people to the islands?
Yes.
After the war?
The Alaska Native Service.
Well, how did they make out when they went back there?
In the village of Attu, where my wife and I were located, the natives had to build completely a new village. We saw the completion of 22 new homes, the government school building, a cooperative store, and a beautiful little Russian church.
Were you down there at the time on research, or were you connected with the rebuilding?
We were attached to the Alaska Native Service.
Mm-hmm.
In Juneau.
Helping the people get back on their feet again.
Yes.
Well, that's quite a project. You practically have to start from the ground up, wouldn't you, to establish a balance for life down there? Or did they become acclimated very well?
Oh, they fell right into it. Of course, they know the islands, and all during their years of evacuation had hoped to return. And when they finally returned, they fell right into the original life as it was before the war.
Did you, while you were working down there with the people in their rehabilitation, did you also do research at the time?
We did some in whatever time we could set aside for it. My wife gathered 85 specimens of the flowering flora for the Botanical Gardens in New York, the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., the Research Museum at the University of Michigan, and Iowa State College.
And you plan on going ahead with this work now?
We did some research in music, in the native music there, and gathered what we could of the folk lore. There isn't very much left among those people, and we find that their music is practically all influenced by the music of the Russian church in which they worship and which has been established since 150 years ago.
It takes a lot of research then to glean out the true culture of the islands.
Yes, it's practically gone in the Aleutians.
Are you confining your studies to the Aleutians alone, or do you plan on traveling throughout Alaska on your work?
I've been along the Arctic coast and hope to continue this work along the Arctic coast.
Simeon, can you tell me just what the point is to the work you're doing?
It is to largely to preserve what little there is left of this culture of the natives of Alaska. Mm-hmm. And not working among the Indians of southeastern Alaska, for that work has been touched upon by many people.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that the work along the Arctic is very much more important at the time.
Mm-hmm. And I presume that you will go on lecturing and perhaps write?
Yes, using my findings along the coast and in the Aleutians as a basis for all of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see our time is about up, Simeon. I want to thank you very much for coming up and telling us about your work. And may I wish you every measure of success in preserving the folklore and the music of the real Alaskans.
Thank you, Jack.
Seven:30 on a Wednesday evening is time for Here's a Pioneer. It's a weekly presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company, which is located across from the Nordale Hotel, and their telephone number, 24 hours a day, is East 10A. The distinguished studio visitor for this week, a genuine old-timer of Alaska, is Mrs. Luther C. Hess. Mrs. Hess, it's customary on this program to open with the question, how did you happen to come to Alaska?
In 1902, when I was graduating from the University of Minnesota, a friend who sat next to me in pedagogy asked me if I would like to go to Everett, Washington, that her uncle had sent her a formal application blank for her to fill out if she cared to go there to teach. I filled out this application blank, giving my age and height and weight and everything about myself. As it happened, the woman, Emma Sarepta Yule, who was now the superintendent of the schools in Juneau, Alaska, had formerly been superintendent of the Everett schools at Everett, Washington. And she, when she took over her position in Juneau, went back to Everett to find some teachers. She didn't find any of her old teachers who cared to go to Alaska, so she went to the superintendent's office and out of 1,500 applications, picked out five, wrote the same letter to all five, offering him this position as assistant principal of the high school at Juneau. I received my letter from her about the 19th of August. I read the letter, then I telephoned to my father to come home for lunch that I was going to Juneau, Alaska to teach. He laughed and he thought I was joking.
Your parents must have thought you were taking off for the end of the world.
When he came and read the letter, he said, well, if you have the courage to go, I'll furnish the money. So as soon as he finished his lunch, we went to the telegraph office and I wired my acceptance. In 2 days, I had a wire from Miss Yule telling me to proceed to Seattle and that I must take a boat from Seattle to Juneau.
How long did you teach in Juneau?
I taught there 5 years and was reelected for the sixth, but they were opening the high school in Fairbanks, and I thought it would be fine to move to a new camp where the gold was being discovered and there was lots of activity. So I made the trip into Fairbanks with some friends and spent the summer and eventually was given the position of assistant principal of the high school.
Mm-hmm. What was early public school life like here in Fairbanks?
My first teaching was in the old Ford building on the corner of 2nd Avenue. We had 2 years high school work and all of the grades. Julia Bruce was the superintendent of the schools. And at Thanksgiving time, we moved to a new frame building, a schoolhouse that was constructed on the site of the present school building.
Wasn't there a lot of talk about that new frame building being a tremendous waste of the community's money?
That building cost about $22,000. And I don't think that any council was ever criticized more severely than the men who built that building. They felt that this was a camp that would pass away in a very short time, and they were wasting the public funds. And it was in a very short time that we had to take partition the large halls into small rooms for classrooms.
Was it in Fairbanks while you were teaching here that you met Mr. Hess?
The night that I arrived in Fairbanks, 1907, 14th of July, Mr. Hess came to the house to take the friend whom I knew and had known in Juneau, take her to a party. So he really was the first man I met after I came to Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. And I have had a good deal of fun telling my friends in the States that I married the first man I met.
Mr. Hess was engaged in both banking and mining in the early days, wasn't he?
I think Mr. Hess and Mr. Bonifield started the First National Bank. And after he became very much interested in mining, he sold his interest. And except for a short time, he has been vice president of the First National Bank.
Isn't it true that the First National Bank, though located in the same vicinity as right now, it burned at one time and was rebuilt?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm wondering, too, about your connection with the University of Alaska. I wonder if you would go into the story of to whom it first occurred and also how the site was chosen.
The thought of a university in this part of the country came to Judge James Wickersham, who was then delegate to Congress. In 1915, he had a bill passed Congress granting four sections of land as a site for an agricultural college and school of mines. That went with a $50,000 appropriation from the Department of Agriculture went with that grant. And when he returned to his home here in Fairbanks, he wanted to do something to get the idea of a university started here. So he conceived the idea of laying a cornerstone and having an address out on the place where we had selected the site. And that was done.
Mm-hmm. And will you tell us something about the time when you went out there to select the site? What year was that, and who went with you, and what were the conditions in that respect?
That was in 1915 when he returned from Washington. Mr. Groves, who had a good-sized automobile at that time, and automobiles were not very plentiful, and Judge Wickersham had selected Reverend Lumpkin of the Episcopalian Church, and Andrew Nerland, a longtime friend of Judge Wickersham's, and Mrs. Wickersham and myself. We went to this place. And this hill had been the site, as Judge Wickersham said, which he had always thought would be a wonderful place for a college. And we looked over the site. It was heavily wooded. And we thought, when we picked out the site, that we were way back from the brow of the hill. And when we finally had decided on what they thought was a suitable place, Judge Wickersham asked me to mark the exact spot where the first building would be. And I took a good linen handkerchief and tied it to a twig. And that is where the cornerstone is. That was laid on July 15th. We had a big celebration, and Judge Wickersham made an address. But when it came time to build the first building, and the hill was cleared, we felt that to put the building where the cornerstone is would be too near the brow of the hill. So it was moved back, and the flagpole is beside the cornerstone.
What was the first building that was put up there, and is it still there?
The first building is a large frame building called Main Building. We received $60,000 from the legislature in 1917, and all we could do was to build the main portion of a building. Bob Summers, was received the contract for that. Then, as each session, we tried to get more money, and we put on the north wing, or the west wing, and then the next session, the east wing, just as we got money to build.
You know, backtracking a bit, I've always thought that it must have been an achievement on someone's part to get the university located here rather than in some other part of Alaska. Will you tell us about that?
It certainly was an achievement, and I don't think any four men worked harder than Mr. Andrew Nerland, Billy Burns, and Luther Hess, and I don't remember who the others were, but it was a feat to get this $60,000. I've often told people that I felt that something like Columbus, when Isabella pondered jewels and said, go hunt up the earth, I said the legislature gave us $60,000 and said, go build a college.
Didn't you tell me that one of the legislators just didn't believe that clear up here in the land of ice and snow was the place for a university until he finally made a trip through here?
Well, Senator Heckman of Ketchikan, was a very wealthy fish man and very much interested in things. And he fought, and as others did, the idea of an agricultural college up in this part of the country. They couldn't believe that we could raise the things we said they did. And he fought it very strongly. When he came back, he made a trip to here and saw the flowers and the wheat and everything. He certainly profoundly apologized for his efforts against the college.
You know, it seems to me that you were particularly fortunate in obtaining Dr. Bunnell as president for the university when it first began. How did that come about?
I don't suppose any board felt happier and more relieved when we found out that Dr. Bunnell was quitting his position as federal judge. The Democrats were out and the Republicans were in, and he knew he was going to leave. And when we found out that he was very glad to take this little college as just at the beginning and start it and build it, it was certainly was a great relief. And to him goes all the credit for what it is today, and it would be a whole lot more if we could only have the money to do the things that and make the university give it the facilities to perform the service to the territory for which it was erected or built.
The statement you've just made just about sets up the question that I had in mind for next. It combines two questions. Do you believe that the university has received appropriations enough? And also, do you have any ideas about the future of the University of Alaska?
Well, the university has never had money enough to do any of the things that it could do if it could have the facilities. We appreciate the fact that this is a big territory and there are not so many businesses and ways of earning money and all, but the university, if it could have the money, it could do a great deal more. And we're very much handicapped since the veterans have come.
Now, Mrs. Hess, changing from the subject of the University of Alaska, isn't it true that you, for a time, were vitally interested in welfare work in this division?
At one time, the welfare work in the territory was carried on by committees in each division, consisting of the federal judge, United States Marshal, and one woman. And this law was passed in 1913 and was discontinued in 1935 when the work was all taken over by the Welfare Board. I was appointed in 1913 and served up to the time the board was discontinued.
And that, I believe, Mrs. Hess, takes care of our time for this program of Here's a Pioneer. Friends, you've listened to a 15-minute interview with Mrs. Luther C. Hess. Here's a Pioneer, bringing you one of Alaska's genuine old-timers each Wednesday evening at 7:30, is brought to you by the Pioneer Cab Company, which is located across from the Nordale Hotel, and their telephone number is East 10A. We suggest that you listen again for Here's a Pioneer next Wednesday evening at 7:30.
What did you say?
Wednesday evening at 7:30 is time for Here's a Pioneer. It's the weekly presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company, operated by Joe Kobel, located across from the Nordale Hotel, and their telephone number, 24 hours a day, is East 10A. Tonight we have not one pioneer, but two distinguished pioneer visitors to the studio. We have Mrs. C.D. O'Flanagan, who came to the North in 1897, and then we have Mrs. Minnie Brewis, who came to Alaska in 1899. Two of the pioneering ladies of the Northern Territory. And first, I'm going to ask a few questions of Mrs. O'Flanagan to see what she remembers from 1897. First, I think it would be fitting and proper, Mrs. O'Flanagan, to ask, what was your home down there in the States?
St. Louis, Missouri.
You came from St. Louis, and whatever made you decide to come north?
Well, we read the papers about the boats coming in with all the gold.
So you wanted some of that gold, too?
Sure.
What date did you hit Seattle?
January the 22nd, 1897.
January 22nd of 1897. And did you come alone, or did you come with some members of your family?
I came with my husband and son.
Uh-huh. What sort of a trip did you have to Alaska? What boat did you come on?
On the Corona.
You came on the Corona. Was it an eventful trip? Did you have anything of particular importance that happened on that voyage?
Well, it was wrecked on Lewis Island.
Well, that's all. Just wrecked on, on an island. Was that in American or Canadian territory?
That was in Canada.
Was the ship lost completely?
Yes, it sunk.
I wonder if you'd recall that incident and tell us some of the details, just how it happened.
Well, they employed all kinds of captains that didn't know the route, and we was 100 miles out of our course. And mm-hmm. when we run on the reef of the island.
Uh-huh. Did the ship break up suddenly?
Well, no, she just sunk. She just filled up.
Mm-hmm. How many passengers were there aboard?
309.
309 people. Did they all get off all right?
Well, two stowaways was drowned.
I see. And how did you get away from the wreck?
We went in a lifeboat.
Mm-hmm. How long were you in the lifeboat, and where did you go ashore?
Well, it wasn't long. It wasn't very far to the island.
Mm-hmm. Were you on that island very long?
We was a week on the island because they couldn't find us.
And then finally another boat came along and picked you up.
Yeah, the Humboldt.
Mm-hmm. I see. Then you traveled on the Humboldt, and instead of being scared of the North and turning around, you kept coming right up to Skagway. Is that right?
Yeah, we went first to Wrangell, Alaska.
Uh-huh. And did you stay very long in Wrangell?
We stayed there till July the 4th.
Mm-hmm. And then you kept on coming up into...
Going to Skagway.
Uh-huh. Now, what was Skagway like at that time? Was it a rip-roaring town?
I should say.
Did you see our old friend Soapy Smith there?
I didn't see him. He just killed before we arrived.
Just a few days before you arrived, Soapy Smith was shot, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's it.
Didn't you say that you visited his grave?
Huh?
Didn't you say that you visited Soapy Smith's grave?
We put flowers on, wild flowers.
Uh-huh. I see. Then you got ready to go up over the pass. What was your mode of travel? I don't think there was a railroad there at that time.
Well, we went with wagon for 18 miles, and then we camped all night, and we went on horseback, but that was too rough, and so we had a walk. I had a walk, a walk till to the custom.
Oh, yes.
On the summit.
Customs station.
Yeah.
You had your baby on your back, didn't you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We had him in a gunny sack, and we transferred.
How old was your baby?
He was a year old.
Did he have any trouble? Was he difficult to take care of?
Oh, at times, because sometimes it rained and was awful hard to walk there.
I imagine that would be some trip with a one-year-old baby. And then did you have any particular hardships going up over the top after you passed the customs station there?
Well, the mounted police taking us by boat over a lake. They said that there's a fire on the other side, and then before we crossed the lake, the wind turned and caught us, and then we
forest
had wet
fire.
Blankets over us. Yeah.
Wet blankets over
yes.
you? Really was close then.
Yes.
What did you do about the baby during that forest fire?
Oh, I had him all covered up.
Uh-huh. And he got through all right.
Yeah.
Now, what about the water trip to Dawson? How did you make that?
Well, we built two scows at Bennett. And then we was about 18 in the party. You see, they all helped build the scows.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went it was all rough traveling, Windy Arm and all them places. That awful time at Windy Arm.
Oh, what was the trouble there?
Well, the wind is so bad, and we had all kinds of trouble there. But then we got out all right.
Mm-hmm. I see. And then you shot through the rapids, all right?
We went to the
Miles
White Horse Rapids. They through the canyon first.
Uh-huh.
And just before we got White Horse Rapids, there was a terrible whirlpool, or eddy, or whatever they call it, but it was an awful, and our scow got in. And they all had to jump for their lives. And, of course, I was left with my son.
Uh-huh.
And they all lined up on the side was a sandbank.
Oh, yes.
And they told me to throw the child. And I thrown the child, and my husband caught it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I jumped, and they caught me, too.
Oh, that really must have been thrilling. Did you ever think during the trip that you... wished you hadn't come and would like to turn back to St. Louis?
No.
You still feel the same way, too. Uh-huh. Well, that certainly is interesting. Then the rest of the way down to Dawson, you made out all right, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Well, at the Five Finger Rapids, we went through the long channel, you know. And they went early in the morning because we were seven women.
Oh.
So we saw the way. Mm. And they went through the wrong channel, and then the water came all over us in our bunks. And we got a terrible trenching. That was about all.
Mm-hmm. But the baby made it through there all right,
oh,
too.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he was better than any of us.
Never worried about those
things. He never
things.
Known anything.
Well, about Dawson in 1897, in the summer of 97, what kind of a town was it?
It was really, there was nearly 60,000 people there at that time, and there was nearly all tents.
It must have been a bedlam then.
Yes.
All tents and very few board buildings.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first house we had, we bought scows
mm-hmm.
and built a house. We couldn't get no lumber.
Mm-hmm. And how about the prices there in 97?
Oh, they were pretty steep.
Mm-hmm. How long did you stay in Dawson?
I stayed about 8 years, I think.
Then where did you go?
To Fairbanks.
You came to Fairbanks. You've been here ever since.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you ever so much, Mrs. C.D. O'Flanagan. We've certainly appreciated having you on Here's a Pioneer. And now I'm going to turn the microphone over in the direction of Mrs. Minnie
You're
Brewis,
welcome.
Who is also a guest on the program tonight. Mrs. Brewis, I see that the date of your coming to Alaska is 1899. Now, that would be 48 years ago. And what time of the year was it when you decided to come north?
Well,
what month of the year?
What month?
Yes.
March of 99.
March of 1899. Mm-hmm. And did you come alone or with
no.
members of your family?
No, my father's.
Your father, now...
My mother.
I believe your family name is well known up in this
yes.
country, and you have a lot of friends. Now, what is that family name? Will you tell us?
Wechter.
Wechter. And what was the purpose of your father's coming north?
Well, to bring cattle in and sell them to make
mm-hmm.
a steak. Like
your first definite stopping point up here was Skagway, wasn't it?
Skagway.
Uh-huh. Now, how many head of cattle did he bring north?
The first time, he brought 100.
100 head of cattle.
And
how did he get along with them? Was there any difficulty
well,
there?
He started over the Dalton Trail.
Uh-huh.
That is the trail that they leave the coast at Haines.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't go over the trail on account of the water.
Mm.
So they had to go back. They got partway, and they went back to Skagway and wintered the cattle
all winter. That must have been sort of an economic blow to him to maintain 100 head of cattle at Skagway, Alaska,
yes,
in the winter of 1899. He had plenty to worry about. I can see that.
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm. Well, did they all live through the winter pretty well? Mm-hmm.
Yes, they did.
Then how did he get them up the next
season?
Well,
he drove them over this White Pass Trail and took them to Lake Bennett and built scows and floated down the Yukon.
Oh, did they, most of them make it all right down the
Yukon?
Oh,
yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
I was thinking that maybe some of those fellows up there might have enjoyed some steak on the trail.
No, he didn't kill any of them until they got to Dawson.
Is that right?
He fed them. And
mm-hmm. Now, I have so far inquired about the riding herd over the pass, but I'd like to know something of your trip. What ship did you make that trip on?
The City of Seattle.
The City of Seattle. I'm sure that's the boat that many of the old-timers listening will remember. Now, did you have any difficulties, anything like the troubles that Mrs. O'Flanagan told us about?
No.
You made a clean trip
right
to
the Skagway. We made
a clean trip mm-hmm.
to Skagway.
And then how about the jaunt up over the hump, over the pass?
Well, we was on the train till we got to very near to the summit, and that was as far as the White Pass was built.
Uh-huh.
And my sister and I were alone. And we were on our way to Bennett, Lake Bennett.
Oh, yes.
To go down the Yukon with one of my brothers on a scow, and he was building it at Lake Bennett. So we walked over this trail, and on the ties of the railroad, we were all alone that 2 days.
I see.
Of course, there were a lot of people on the trail, but...
Oh, sure. You found your brother down on the other side.
Yes.
Getting ready to go. Mm-hmm. How long did you wait before you made the water trip?
About 3 weeks.
Did you have your troubles going through the canyon and the rapids?
Yes.
Anything happen there?
No,
what did you see?
No. We didn't see much of anything, only just water ahead and trying to get through. No.
Didn't you mention before the broadcast that you saw a lot of dead horses down in there?
No.
Oh, that was Mrs. O'Flanagan.
Mrs. O'Flanagan.
Mm-hmm, I see.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that a lot of men lost their lives down there in Miles Canyon in Five Fingers Rapids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then...
there was a lot of wrecks.
There were. Wrecks of outfits.
The scows, the outfits.
That tried to get through and never made it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And after you got through the rapids, the canyon and the rapids, and then you came to Dawson in 99, did you seem to believe that Dawson was the place where you wanted to make yourself a home?
Well, my father had been there the winter before.
Oh.
And he had established a meat market.
Yes.
And, of course, we were felt like we were going home because Father had this market, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And but they didn't stay. My father and the boys didn't stay. They decided that there was a very good sale for meat, so they turned around and went back to get more cattle and calves and hogs. And my sister and I were left in Dawson alone that summer. But we put in our time building furniture out of this scow that we rode down the river.
That must have been some furniture, too.
Well, we didn't know how large a bed would be, so we built it 6 foot square.
Plenty of room for everybody. Now, how about the other work that you did there? Didn't you sell potatoes at Dawson?
Well, my brother had potatoes on this scow, potatoes, oranges, and lemons.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Dawsonites, as soon as the scow would tie up at the bank, they were very anxious to know what we had.
Mm-hmm.
And they came down to the bank to see what we had, and when we told them we had potatoes, why, they were been eating dried fruit and beans, and they were very anxious to have something fresh.
Well, their problem there was scurvy, wasn't it?
Yes, mm-hmm. at that time.
And how much did they pay you for the potatoes?
Well, when we... they called for a potato, and we threw it up on the bank, and they'd throw us 25 cents.
That sounds like a pretty good arrangement. And now, how long did you stay in Dawson?
Well, from 99 to 1904.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go after 1904?
I came to Fairbanks.
Fairbanks, and you've been here ever since.
Well, I've been to the Iditarod.
Oh, you followed the strike into the Iditarod country.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any adventures over there?
Well... only just every day. I got lost going in.
How long were you lost?
Oh, we lost about 2 days.
Mm-hmm. And you finally decided that Fairbanks was the place to settle definitely.
Well, the dredges went into the Adair Rod and bought up all the ground on Flat Creek, and of course then we came to Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm. I see. How do you like Fairbanks for a home?
Well, I've been here so many years, I wouldn't know where else to go.
Well, we think it's a pretty good place, as we know you think, too.
Yes.
So, that pretty well covers the story for both Mrs. C.D. O'Flanagan and then the most recent interviewee, Mrs. Minnie Brewis. Friends, you've listened to the program Here's a Pioneer, brought to you every Wednesday evening at 7:30 by the Pioneer Cab Company. And we suggest that you listen again next Wednesday at 7:30 for Here's a Pioneer, brought to you by Pioneer Cab, telephone East 10A. 7:30 on a Wednesday evening is time for Here's a Pioneer. It's a weekly presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company, which is located across from the Nordale Hotel. And their telephone number, 24 hours a day, is East 10A. And this week's genuine old-timer is Mr. George Preston, manager of the Fairbanks station of the Northern Commercial Company, and I feel sure that Mr. Preston is known to hundreds and hundreds of our interior Alaska listeners. Now, Mr. Preston, I believe I will begin by asking, what was your home before you came to Alaska?
I was born in Scotland and lived there until I was 22 years of age.
Then did the call of adventure to the Northland, to Alaska, lure you up here, or was it some kind of business connection?
Well, I was offered a position as bookkeeper at the mine with one of the London companies that was then operating in the Klondike on Hunker Creek.
Now, I can imagine that in that time, the trip all the way from England to the Klondike was really something to remember. Do you have any recollection of how long it took you?
Well, it was quite interesting, naturally, to a young fellow who had not traveled very far from home. And my journey took me first to Liverpool, where I got one of the Allen Line boats, a new boat called the Tunisian. We came on the Tunisian to Montreal. From Montreal, I crossed on the Canadian Pacific to Vancouver, B.C., I was held up there for a few days because the boat leaving for the north was not ready to sail. But in due time, I left on the Kutch, which was then one of the small boats running between Vancouver and Skagway.
Did you have an eventful trip from Vancouver to Skagway?
No, there was nothing especially eventful. It was just one of the normal trips at that time, and we made it without any particular incident that I can recall.
Mm-hmm. How about your transportation from Skagway into the Klondike?
Well, there again, there was some delay because it was the early part of the season, and they were building the White Pass Road at that time, but it was not quite completed, and there were delays, naturally, incident to a new road just going into operation.
What year did you say this was?
This was in 1900.
Uh-huh.
And the first stage of the journey from Skagway took me over to the head of Lake Bennett. The road at that time was not completed round Lake Bennett, and so we had to take a boat from Lake Bennett, which landed us at the Caribou Crossing.
Mm-hmm. Is that the boat that you mentioned earlier that landed you on the bottom of the river for a while?
Oh, no, that was another boat entirely.
Oh, I see.
That was operating in the lake entirely.
I understand that the river boats and the lake boats didn't have their troubles then as they do now.
Well, there were plenty of troubles. Mm-hmm. Always are troubles in the navigating of these rivers, of mm-hmm. course, with shifting sandbars.
Uh-huh.
But from Lake Bennett, as I said, we went to Caribou Crossing in a boat. The railroad had been built from Caribou Crossing to Whitehorse, but had just been completed when we arrived there, and I was on the first train that went over it. We went very slowly, naturally, over the new road because it was not properly ballasted. The conveyance was one engine, a passenger coach, and a baggage coach, small baggage coach. The passenger coach was filled up with the few women that were traveling and the older men. Mm-hmm. And the rest of us, young fellows, dogs, baggage, natives, we were all loaded in indiscriminately into the baggage car and sat on the floor or baggage or wherever we could find a place to sit down.
Uh-huh. Any kind of transportation in those days was acceptable, I suppose.
Well, we naturally had to rough it some.
Sure.
We didn't expect the luxuries that people ask for these days and demand, as a matter of fact.
Well, how did you get along going to Dawson then?
Well, then after the landing at White Horse, we had time to visit the rapids and waited around, I guess, a day or two, as I recall. I forget the exact time we waited before it was announced that the boat was leaving for downriver. The boat was the steamer U-Connor. We started on a Sunday evening, and I felt when the boat had finally cast off that we were on our way to Dawson. We'd be there in a couple of days. But I didn't know the difficulties of navigation, because we had just reached the head of Lake Lebarge when we ran right onto a bar. And we stayed there for, it seemed to me, 2 days, although I have no exact recollection of how long we did stay there. But it was 2 days, I'm sure. And the crew made every effort to get off the bar by putting out dead men and using cables and winches. And on one occasion, I recall, they had kicked up enough sand so that there was a little island right alongside the boat. And a woman on the boat conceived the idea of putting her little dog down there. She had a little fox terrier, and she laid the little dog down on this little island.
Uh-huh.
It was eventually decided that we could not get off with the load of passengers and freight that we had on. And so the steamer Canadian came up the lake from the south, or from the north, and we were loaded on a barge and a small boat that they had there called the Joseph Closet took us out to the Canadian when we were the passengers were all transferred there, mm-hmm. along with their baggage.
And then what sort of trip did you have?
Then the trip from there on was quite all right, because we, in a day and a half, as I recall it, we landed in Dawson.
Mm-hmm.
Along about 3 o'clock in the morning, and at that time, early in June, it was bright daylight, and it all seemed very wonderful to me to come into this gold metropolis and find such a crowd of people waiting at the dock there for the first arrival of this boat.
I imagine that really was an event.
It was quite an event these mm-hmm. days to watch the arrival of the boats coming in, and particularly the early boats loaded with friends and new people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite a line of people you had to go through to reach the street.
From our earlier discussion, Mr. Preston, I understand that one of your first recollections of Dawson was a man with tired feet. Isn't that right?
Oh, well, that was when we landed at White Horse that early morning. There was an old man on board. I remember he had apparently had some trouble with his corns, because I saw him sit between the rails, take off his shoes, and begin to fix his feet, his corns.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was rather a comical incident in the circumstances.
I suppose corns and tired feet were just something that went hand in hand with pioneering in those days.
Well, he was an old man. Apparently it was something he had trouble with.
Well, as I understand it now, you did not live in Dawson for any time at all. You lived at one of the mining
camps. I was on Hunker Creek, which was 10 or 12 miles out of Dawson.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite an arduous journey to get there, because there were no roads such as we know today. And so we had to take pack horses to carry our baggage out, and we had to walk the way ourselves, all the way.
Mm-hmm. How long did you live out there before you moved to this vicinity?
Well, I was in Dawson until the fall of 1902.
Mm-hmm.
Then I came out to Vancouver for the winter. because I had resigned from the company I was with, and could see no particular future there, and came out to Vancouver. From there, I got a fresh start by coming up the following spring, in the month of March, to Valdez. There was a gold strike in the Nazina country, tributary of the Copper River, and I had some friends who were going in there. I came up and joined them, and we went into the Nazina country and spent the summer there.
Any particular excitement there in that segment of your journey?
Well, yes, it was an interesting trip, of course, and quite a difficult one, because we had to take all our supplies in again by dog team, and we had to go over the Marshall Pass down into the Tasnuna River, down the Tasnuna to the Copper, and all the way by dragging your sleds and with assistance of the dogs, of course.
Well, I'm very much interested, too, in knowing about when you finally got to Fairbanks.
Well, we came out to Valdez that fall in September, and we stayed there for about a month, or a little over, and got to get organized to come into the Tanana. And we started off the day after Thanksgiving. I was one of a member of a party of two, but there were other three parties traveling along with us. I forget the number of men, but 10 altogether, as I recall it, in this party, and a lot of dogs. And we made the trip in about 6 weeks, because we arrived here on the 4th of January, 1904. And that was my first entrance into Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm. What about the NC Company at that stage of the game? I suppose it didn't amount to very much.
It was a very small place. It had only been set up about a year, or less than a year. And I was not with the NC Company at that time. My partner and I went out to the creeks, to Fairbanks Creek, and tried our hand at mining. My partner was a miner, but I knew very little about the practice of the game, and when it came towards spring, I felt that I had better get back to something I knew about.
And so that was the NC Company.
And so I had an introduction to the manager of the NC Company and came in and got a job.
What sort of a store did they have at that time? I suppose it didn't amount to much.
Well, it was a very small place. The original store is still where the grocery store is now. But it was only about one-third or one-half the depth that it is now, and very small area. That included the office and everything.
I see. How about the utilities? When did they come into the country?
Well, at the time I came there, of course, there were no utilities. There was no electric light plant. There was no heating plant. We simply had wood stoves for heating, and we had kerosene lamps for light. And those who were fortunate to have them, and the others had to put up with candles.
I understand the first light system you had was DC current.
It was DC current.
And probably not adequate for very long either.
It was not the... this alternating current was practically a new thing at that time. And we were advised by the engineers we consulted in San Francisco to put in a DC plant, because it was assumed that the life of the camp would only be about 20 years. That had been the experience in other placer camps, that 20 years would work them out.
Now, of course, we can see where the assumption is wrong.
They didn't really know what conditions were ahead of us, because there were developments that none of us could have foreseen at that time.
Now I wonder about the plans of the NC Company, particularly in the branch of utilities.
Well, we're now nearing the end of our second franchise with the city. The first franchise extended for 25 years, and the next franchise was for a period of 20 years. That has got approximately 3 years still to run. But there has been such an increase in demand for power and the other services that we can easily see where, before the end of our present franchise, the plant will be absolutely inadequate, even with the tie-in we have with the FE company, to supply the demand that there will be.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And consequently, we are looking towards the time when there will be a much larger plant constructed. And we ourselves have declared ourselves in readiness to start that plant. But naturally, before we would contemplate such a heavy investment, we would want to know that we were protected by a franchise.
I understand that that is something under public discussion now.
The matter is before the town council for their next move, and all that concerns us now is that there should be some pressure got behind the matter so that there will not be too great a delay, because in the present state of trade, it is very easy to see that no plant such as we contemplate putting in could be installed any earlier than, say, 3 to 5 years from today, if you'd even started your arrangements at this time.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Preston. Our time is up now, and we certainly appreciate your appearance on Here's a Pioneer. Friends, you've listened to another presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company, which is located across from the Nordale Hotel, telephone number East 10A. This week's guest on Here's a Pioneer has been Mr. George Preston, manager of the Fairbanks station of the Northern Commercial Company. Be with us again next Wednesday evening at 7:30.